Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org. Additional support comes from the Jackson Laboratory, researching the root causes of cancer and other genetic diseases, designated a cancer center by the National Cancer Institute, JAX.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Two championship droughts ended this week when the Mavericks and the Bruins took home trophies. Ahead on Only a Game, a look at some of the cities with the longest winless streaks and at some of the lovable losers bound to become detestable winners. Also, the links between golf and politics and the life of baseball great Stan Musial. Also ahead, Karen Given fires off a few rounds with the Divas of Dallas.
They look at me and they give me a once-over and they go, really? Yes, I shoot. What do you shoot? Pistols, rifles, shotguns. Then they just get quiet because they don't really know what to say about that.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The hapless Twins, although their wins have lately come in bunches, have seen a lot of other teams consuming all their lunches, while Boston Sox, who left the box as if they didn't care, have won enough since April's streak to laugh at spring's despair. Joining me now to comment on various developments in Major League Baseball is ESPN's Tim Kirkjian. Tim, welcome back to Only a Game.
Great to be here, Bill. Very clever poem there.
Well, thank you very much. I'm going to put that on the back of the next book, if you don't mind. The Cleveland Indians began the season well, and despite predictions that their success would be fleeting, they are still fighting for the top spot in the AL Central. How long will they contend?
I think they're in trouble here, Bill, and yet I still think they'll be able to contend in the AL Central for quite a while, in part because the AL Central just isn't as good as we thought it was. However, neither are the Indians. The Indians started out 30-15, best record in baseball, and I saw them on a Monday night in Cleveland when they had the best record in baseball. Then I saw them 3 weeks later, and from that point on, in those 3 weeks, they had the worst record in baseball. They had the highest ERA in baseball and the lowest runs per game in baseball, all in a three-week period. And exactly how they did that, I'm not quite sure, but I think it's the fact that they didn't hit, they've got some key injuries, they've got some young guys on that team that probably don't know what to do when they hit a big losing streak, but it's still really impressive where they are to this day. I just don't think they're going to have enough to win that division.
Detroit stands in Cleveland's way, at least for the time being. Starting pitcher Justin Verlander is a big reason for the Tigers' success so far, and he's scheduled to pitch tomorrow. So can we expect, what, a one-hitter, a two-hitter, or we'll be disappointed, right?
We will not be disappointed with the way that he's throwing the ball lately. I've seen him pitch a dozen times in person, Bill, and I never understand how anyone ever gets a hit off of him. He throws, at his best, 100 miles an hour. He throws a curveball that just calcifies hitters, and now he's got a very good changeup to go with that. And he worked on some things this spring to try to simulate the beginning of the season in spring training to get him better, you know, in April, where he had always struggled. That kind of worked, but now he's at the top of his game, and that is simply breathtaking to watch.
Philadelphia currently has the best record of any major league team. They've been strong for some time now. What accounts for that?
Well, that starting pitching, Bill, which we've talked about ever since the day Cliff Lee signed, has been really, really good, which is no surprise. But even with some injuries to that rotation, their bullpen's been way better than anybody thought it would be, especially with some injuries that they've had. And they're still not a great offensive team in any way, Bill, but they're better because they have Chase Utley back. He is the heart and soul of that team in every way. If I was a Phillies fan, I would be thrilled with where my team was right now, because I think they're going to get better from here, meaning the rotation's going to be healthier, and eventually they're going to score more runs than they have to this point.
It was supposed to be a dogfight this season between St. Louis and Cincinnati in the National League Central, and it has been a dogfight, but Milwaukee has crashed the party as well. Do the Brewers continue to reside near the top of the division?
I think so, Bill. I just saw the Cardinals the other day, and the Cardinals have some issues. I think the Reds have a few more issues than they did last year, which opens the door for the Brewers to be much, much better. Their starting rotation is demonstrably better than it was at this time last year with Sean Markham and Zach Greinke. Their offense, when everybody stays healthy, is very, very good. The key is their defense. They have Garth Orge, formerly of the Blue Jays a million years ago, in to kind to help them with their positioning. He's got some radical ideas on how to play defense, but it has been better. Keep in mind, Bill, they have not had one Gold Glove winner for the Brewers since Robin Yount. Not one. That's just amazing to me.
Garth Orge was always one of my favorite baseball names. I'm delighted you brought him up in whatever context.
Had a great guy.
We only have a few minutes, so we can't talk about all the Major League Baseball teams, all 30 of them, but which notables, good or bad, should we bring up?
Well, I'm really interested to see what the Cubs do this weekend, for instance, from the bad side against the Yankees. If the Cubs are going to get back in this, which I don't see any chance, we have to see what they can do this weekend against the Yankees. That's from the bad. From the good, I'm fascinated by what the Seattle Mariners are doing. They were hideous last year, and right now they are in contention in the AL West with very strong pitching. Friday they called up Dustin Ackley, who's their young second baseman who can really hit. So just when you think the Mariners had no chance to contend this year, now you look at the AL West and say they have a chance to stay in this for a long time. And that's what we love about baseball, Bill, how many times we can be wrong. And boy, was I wrong this year already on a lot of things.
Finally, Tim, Mets reliever DJ Carrasco balked home the winning, or actually more accurately, the losing run against the Braves on Thursday night. I guess there are crazier ways to end extra inning games, but that has to be among them.
Yeah, that's only the second time in the history of the New York Mets that they lost a game on a walk-off balk. First off, Bill, I am really opposed to the phrase a walk-off balk, but if you watched it, there was a big cluster at home plate when the winning run scored on a walk-off balk. All the guy had to do was walk home. And I think we're taking it. Look, I'm all for post-game celebrations, but when you walk home on a balk, I'm not sure there should be a dog pile at home plate to celebrate it. But it's very unusual, obviously, only twice in the history of the New York Mets, and that's a really, really bad way to lose a game.
Tim Kirkchin covers baseball for ESPN. He joins me from time to time to talk about the game as well. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
When the Boston Bruins beat the Vancouver Canucks in Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Finals on Wednesday night, Bruins fans got their first opportunity in 39 years to celebrate the return of the Cup to Boston. After Game 6, Mark Recchi, the 43-year-old Bruin who'd previously played on Cup winners in Pittsburgh and Carolina, had the perspective to discuss the impact winning would have on Boston's fans.
You know, 70-72, the last time the city got to see a Stanley Cup, and I mean, this is a great sports town, great hockey town, and, you know, obviously it'd be pretty remarkable. I mean, there's been a lot of success here with the other sports teams, and the Bruins included, but it's been a long time.
Of course, perspective is all, or perspective and geography are all. Each winner leaves a disappointed loser behind. Before that happened on Wednesday night, Damian Cox, who writes about hockey for the Toronto Star, speculated on what winning the Cup would mean for the Canucks, a franchise that has never experienced that thrill.
Vancouver doesn't really have another team that they can lean on. It's really been decades of heartbreak, of being close, of sort of being a bit of a star-crossed franchise in a lot of ways. And from that perspective, winning the Cup in a place where the team has an unusually large attachment to the city, I think would probably be bigger in Vancouver.
Maybe so. But the Vancouver Canucks only came into existence in 1970. By then, a certain baseball team in Chicago had already been enduring a championship drought for 62 years. And that drought is still in progress. Alex Gertzma, now a doctor in Connecticut, began attending Cubs games with his father when he was seven in 1955. He most recently saw them in an interleague game.
It so happens I was in Fenway on the Friday that the Cubs came in, and I wore both my Cubs Ernie Banks jersey and a Red Sox hat. Everybody seemed to welcome us as though we were long-lost brethren.
Since it's been over 100 years since the Cubs have been champions, I asked Dr. Gertzma if he ever thought about finding another favorite team.
Only every season. Every now and then what will happen is I'll say, I'm not going to look up the scores. They're in a terrible losing streak. It's not going to happen this year. And then, of course, what they do is they have a few games where they win, and then I get hooked all over again. I guess it's an addiction.
It's a sad tale, certainly, albeit one oft-told. But sports fans from Chicago have had champions to cheer. Michael Jordan's Bulls nearly retired the NBA's Larry O'Brien trophy, and the Bears won a Super Bowl in 1986. In at least one other city of several pro teams, that sounds pretty good. I'm thinking Cleveland, of course, where, according to Cleveland Plain Dealer columnist Terry Pluto, drought doesn't begin to describe the situation.
I think scorched earth is really what you're looking for, Bill. The last time a major sports franchise here won a title was 1964, when the Browns won the NFL title. Notice I didn't say Super Bowl. There was no Super Bowl in 1964. The Browns have not even been to the Super Bowl to lose in the Super Bowl.
The Indians were losers in the 95 and 97 World Series. The Cavaliers were swept out of the 07 NBA Finals, and those were the high points. When you've endured a stretch like that with your teams, do you find yourself rejoicing with fans in cities that have endured droughts of their own and put their troubled history behind them? Meh, Terry Pluto told me, not so much.
You sit there and go, okay, well, there's two more teams that won a title before any of our teams did. And that list gets smaller and smaller. And that then all usually inspires a few emails that I get from fans saying, well, I see a championship before I die, and I always write back, how many decades do you plan to live?
Winning a championship can inspire stupid and destructive behavior. We saw that in Detroit when the Red Wings won the Stanley Cup in 2008 and in 2004 when the Red Sox finally brought a World Series title to Boston for the first time since 1918. Losing a championship series can set off a portion of the fan base, too. It happened this week in Vancouver. But according to Terry Pluto, fans in Cleveland may be too numb for excess. He told me that after the Indians lost in 97, everybody just went back to work. Despite a strong start, the Indians are not likely to find themselves in the World Series this fall, and nobody's picking the Browns for the next Super Bowl. Fans of the Cavaliers have to be content that ex-Cav LeBron James and the team he joined in Miami didn't win either. But should the world wag on long enough, on some distant day, those Indians will win, as will the Browns and the Cavaliers. The same goes for the Buffalo Bills and the Sabres, the Lions, the Bengals and the Padres, and even those apparently blighted Cubs. Certainly it will happen, and the champagne will run in rivers down Waveland Avenue, or at least the beer will, flowing over and around the celebrating Cubs fans, some of whom never thought it would happen, and they will turn to each other, and they will say, championship drought? What championship drought? Look somewhere else for your drought. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Rings are done, said Mark Cuban, the owner of the NBA champion Dallas Mavericks. Mr. Cuban was suggesting that he might give his players something other than rings to commemorate their triumph over the Miami Heat. Finals MVP Dirk Nowitzki, for one, was not happy with that development. We got to talk to him about that, Nowitzki said. He always wants to do something different, but I mean, the ring is just so classic. Speculation about Mr. Cuban's initial intentions ran the gamut from bracelets to huge jewel-encrusted championship belts, which only the larger players would have been able to lift, let alone wear.
Sparkles, spangles, my heart will sing, sing-a-ling-a. Wearing baubles, bangles, and beads.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Stan Musial is celebrated in the eponymous book called Stan Musial. But first, Rory McIlroy, the guy who fumbled away an opportunity to win this year's Masters, double bogeyed the 18th hole at the U.S. Open yesterday afternoon, which means he's only at minus 11 and leads the tournament by about 7 miles. McIlroy followed a first day 65 with a second round 66 to set a record for 36 holes at that tournament. I'm feeling pretty good, McIlroy said after yesterday's round, and no wonder. He went on to say, you know, it's funny to me. It feels quite simple. Today, Rory McIlroy will find out whether round three will feel simple too, or whether he will wish he'd never said that. The U.S. Open isn't the only major golf event happening this weekend. President Barack Obama and Speaker of the House John Boehner are set to stage a so-called golf summit today, playing 18 holes and presumably talking over the nation's business while hooks and slices weave left and right. Jack McCallum's article, The Politics of Golf, appears in a special edition of Sports Illustrated Golf Plus and looks at the history of golfing politicians. Jack, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
There have been a lot of presidential golfers, and we'll get to some of their stories, but a sitting president playing against an opposition party speaker is more than a little unusual, right?
I'd say it's very unusual, particularly given the temper of the times. I mean, these guys are pretty much at each other's throats for 364 days of the year. I can only guess there was a little pressure applied. You know, Boehner kept having a little few hints. Hey, why doesn't the president has to invite me? There has been a lot of talk about golf in Congress. The Democrats have dominated this competition they play in the fall lately. So, I mean, you take all these things together, it's I'm not going to say it's the most interesting match ever involving a president, but, boy, it's got to be there right at the top.
The president and the speaker are not the only duffers in D.C. by a long shot. Tell us about the Congressional Golf Caucus and some of its top players.
Well, first of all, it's hard to believe that there is a Congressional Golf Caucus, but, you know, as I wrote that, I also researched the fact that there's also a skiing caucus. There's an extreme sports caucus, but I think the leader of it is this guy named Representative Joe Baca, who's a semi-controversial Democrat from California. I went down to do the story and was afraid I couldn't find anybody to talk about it because it's sort of a hush-hush subject. Not Baca. He will go give you chapter and verse on how many jobs golf has created, that it's an economy booster. And on his wall, you know, he does not have pictures of Jefferson and Madison. He has pictures of Jack Nicklaus, Chichi Rodriguez, Arnold Palmer, and Tiger Woods. They are his heroes.
Presidents and golf have been linked for more than a century. How did William Howard Taft fare out there on the links?
Well, looking at him, the first thought one would be that he, you know, never missed the meal at the ninth hole. You know, he stood, I think he weighed about 370 pounds. He stood very, very far away from the ball. And he just kind of chopped at it, but he really, really, really enjoyed it. Golf was pretty much in its infancy then. So this is, we're talking about in the 19-teens, even back then, it was considered this rich country club sport, which to a certain extent it is still today. Taft went a long way to popularize it, even though he was not a great player.
Of all the U.S. presidents, Dwight D. Eisenhower might have been the most passionate golfer. Tell us a little bit about his love for the game.
There's no might have about it. I think it was something like during his two terms, the press recorded, or the official White House recording, was 1,000 days spent either playing golf or practicing golf. And perhaps because he was a general, you know, he really didn't care that anyone criticized. It's not like he heard the fact that Babe Ike is golfing again. Yeah, well, so what? I am.
John F. Kennedy was also an avid golfer, but unlike Eisenhower, he kept that fact under wraps.
He had this kind of casual athleticism. Almost everything he did came easily to him, and I've seen a recording of his, you know, tape of his golf swing. And he really was good, and that's, you know, hiding the fact that he had a horrible back. When he was on the campaign trail, because of what had happened with Eisenhower and some of the criticism he had started to get, Kennedy started a ball toward a par three hole and looked like he was going to get a hole in one. and he started screaming at the ball not to go in the hole. So it would not have been, so he would not have had to report. It would have been interesting to know, I mean, whether he would have in fact reported that he had a hole in one, because he didn't want the nation to think that it was getting another first golfer.
There are more golfing presidents than we'll have time to get to right now, so I'm going to just ask you to share a favorite story of a U.S. president swinging the sticks.
You know, one of our colleagues at Sports Illustrated, Rick Riley, played with Clinton. And, you know, Clinton had this reputation for taking mulligans. That's like extra shots. He would just put down another ball and then throw down another ball. And I remember Riley talking about this and just saying what utter fun it was playing with this guy, because, you know, it was almost as if he didn't know that you were watching him. It was almost like he had this presidential shield around him, that was some kind of time warp that you really didn't see the first ball. You know, he would always make a little comment about it, but then put down another one.
Predictably, President Obama is a lefty and Speaker Boehner is a righty. Which of them do you think is more likely to hit the center of the fairway at that golf summit today?
Well, interestingly, Boehner, it's the most screwy twosome. Well, there's a foursome. I guess Biden and I think the governor of Ohio is scheduled to play with him. But it's a screwy foursome because a left-handed golfer is pretty odd. And then Boehner hits right-handed, has a strange stance, but putts left-handed for some reason. So it's a very odd coupling of those two. Boehner is by far the better golfer. But in a match like this, no matter how many strokes Boehner gives to Obama, Obama's probably about 10 strokes worse than Boehner. You always bet on the better golfer.
You know, Jack, there's an awful lot of very complicated betting that goes on at a lot of golf matches. I wonder if we're going to hear, you know, somewhere down the line in history that the health care bill was on the line on the 18th hole. You know, Boehner wins, it goes away. Obama wins, the votes are there.
I almost hope that no serious decisions will be made out there while they're hunting for balls
in the woods.
Yeah, or marking a, or raking a, getting someone to rake a sand trap for him. I just can't see that happening, but I do think it's a kind of platform for future conversation. I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but I mean, to get out there where nobody is beside 10 Secret Service men, I think something could get done in the order of at least this is what we're going to be talking about over the next few weeks or months.
Jack McCallum's article, The Politics of Golf, appears in a special edition of Sports Illustrated Golf Plus. Jack, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
Get on a raft with Taft, boys, get on the winning boat. The man worthwhile with a friendly smile will get the honest vote. He'll save the country, sure, boys, from Brian Hurst and Kraft.
If you'd like to comment on something you've heard on Only a Game, please leave a message on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860.
Of Brian's bluff, we've had enough. He'll talk you deaf and blind. The million trusts he's going to bust are only in his mind. Seems he has run since Washington first started in the game. If his legs were gone, he'd keep right on running just the same.
From 1941 through 1963, Stan Musial demonstrated that he was a terrific baseball player. According to George Vesey, author of a new biography of Musial, Stan the Man was also consistently a benignly positive presence. The biography, titled Stan Musial, An American Life, is full of anecdotes that establish that distinction. George Vesey joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, nice to be back, and I appreciate you picking up on the benignly positive part and the anecdotes. I certainly do have a lot of things in there that expressed that this was a positive man who could reach out and do nice things for other people.
And we're going to get to some of those. But first of all, Stan Musial hit 331 over his 22-year career. He won three Most Valuable Player awards. He was a fixture in the National League All-Star Team's outfield. But he began his career as a pitcher. How'd that work out for him?
Well, clearly it worked out well. He was never quite sure why that they had chosen him as a pitcher when he had already shown that he could hit as well. But he was pitching in the minor leagues, being used in the outfield on occasion, and he made a diving catch, ruined his left shoulder, and he realized that if he was going to stay in baseball, he was going to have to concentrate on hitting. And he had an amazing year. In one year, he went from the low minor leagues to playing for the Cardinals in the last 2 weeks of the season as an outfielder.
There is a sense throughout the biography that Stan Musial never got the attention Joe DiMaggio, Mickey Mantle, Willie Mays, or Ted Williams got, because those guys all played in either New York or Boston. Was giving Musial his due part of your motivation in writing this book?
You know, I can't say that it was. The reality is he was an epic figure in my life. People in St. Louis are much more aware of it than I am because, as I kept telling them, we loved him in Brooklyn. He used to moiter us.
And he got his nickname in Brooklyn.
Exactly. So a couple of Cardinal people were listening to the fans speak our unique Brooklynese language, and they said, what are those people saying? And what they determined through a translator was the people were saying, here comes that man, or here comes the man. So by the time the Cardinals got home to St. Louis, he was Stan the man.
You suppose at one point that the relative lack of attention notwithstanding, Musial might have been better off in St. Louis because, as you put it, New York might have demanded more from him than Stan Musial would have been comfortable giving. What demands did you have in mind?
Well, I'll give you a perfect example. Derek Jeter, who has merely helped win 5 World Series for the Yankees, is somewhat on the decline, happens to be hurt at the moment. And I can hear the Lynch crowds already lining up, younger fans who can't remember that the guy won 5 World Series. I think New York's a tough town. Musial, in a simpler time, it might have made him a little bit more grouchy than the civic delight that he was in St. Louis, where people let him be himself without a lot of extra baggage.
All right, geography and fairness aside, rank Stan Musial compared to, say, Williams, DiMaggio, and Mays.
You know, can I say that I think that rankings are overrated. I can find reasons why all of them are great players, and I can extol them at great length. I think Musial was probably a more complete player than Williams. Even though he had a bad arm, he made himself into a terrific left fielder. He was also willing to play first base whenever a manager needed him for a season here and there. So I can certainly compare him to Williams, who could talk about hitting and probably was the greatest pure hitter because he loved hitting so much. On the other hand, DiMaggio was a stylish center fielder. His ratio of home runs to strikeouts is amazing. He made contact with the ball. And Willie Mays was, you know, and you hate to say one of the great pure players because he was also one of the great intelligent players. And he had power. So I could make a case for any of them. If you were starting a ball team, I'm not so sure that you wouldn't start with Mays and go on from there. But all 4 of them are terrific. You could do no wrong by having any one of the 4 of them.
Musial was a star with the Cardinals when Jackie Robinson joined the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1947. St. Louis was something of a southern town. Numbers of the Cardinals were angry at the integration of baseball. According to many accounts, some of them said they would strike rather than play against the integrated Dodgers. Where did Stan Musial stand in all of that?
Musial's position was very well known to the club and to his teammates. I'm going to play. Growing up in Donora, Pennsylvania, a reasonably integrated town, blacks did have jobs in the mills and could do certain things. Musial had 2 black teammates on his championship basketball team, and his attitude was, I played with those guys, I'm going to play. Now, there are many anecdotes from players, minority players, African-American, Latin-American players, that Musial was a kind presence who would welcome. And Joe Black, to his dying day, told a story about being in the old ballpark in St. Louis and having one of the Cardinals say something nasty from the dugout. And the next day, Musial was waiting for Joe Black by the Cardinal dugout, the pathway from the clubhouse to the field. And he said to him, you didn't have to hear that. I'm sorry you did. You're a good player. You're going to be fine. Nowadays, it's easy to say, well, he should have told the Cardinal management, go hire some black players. It wasn't his style. But in fact, his style was to be kind to everybody, which is way ahead a lot of people's styles.
Your book is full of stories about Musial's generosity, his graciousness with fans, of his strong family ties, but you did turn up one story of Stan Musial as curmudgeon. So tell us about how you heard that story from a former 11-year-old Chicago kid.
Well, this story came in over the transom from somebody online who had heard that I was doing a book on Musial and volunteered the story that when he was an 11-year-old urchin and going to Wrigley Field, that Musial had come out of the player's exit one day, and the kid asked Musial for an autograph, as kids do, and Musial said, "Kid, get out of my way or I'm going to kick you in the shins." Now, this is so unlike Musial, but at least, as I point out, it shows that the man was human. He was capable of at least one flare of temper in his life. I was really happy to have that anecdote because it was like the 0.1% that goes against everything else I learned about him.
You write of Musial that, quote, "he may very well have created a parallel childhood to match other boys' memories of that staple of American childhood, their dad taking them to their first game." Why would Stan Musial have had to do that?
Well, his father was a Polish immigrant, didn't really fit in well even in a town that was filled, a steel and zinc town of Donora, Pennsylvania. The town was filled with immigrants who lived all over the place. And for whatever reason, Lukasz Musial didn't always get the paycheck up the hill to his house on a Friday afternoon. He was not the most stable personality, and he also didn't fit in very well in America. Other people acclimated within one generation. Lukasz didn't care about this American game, this baseball, and there is no evidence. In fact, several times in his own books, Musial said that the first time he went to Forbes Field, he went with other people. It's clear that his father never took him to a baseball game in Pittsburgh. That was way beyond his ability. And yet one time, telling a story to a friend, Musial talked about being in the stands with his father and getting the notion that he wanted to be a baseball player. It's just a sweet story that he wished were true. The fact is the father didn't even want him to play baseball. But by the time Musial was in the World Series in 1942 and brought his father into New York to see him play and, in fact, beat the New York Yankees, the father was very proud of him and died 6 years later, a very proud father.
George Vesey, sports columnist for The New York Times, is the author of Stan Musial, An American Life, published by Ballantine Books, and he joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. George, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for caring about Stan and his life.
It's Stan the man, St. Louis Stan.
To hear more of my conversation with George Vesey, please visit our website, onlyagame.org.
It's Stan the man, St. Louis Stan.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Harvard University, whose summer school has courses for high school, college, and adults to earn academic credit and experience campus life. Summer.harvard.edu. And Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
Most people familiar with baseball know that Barry Bonds has been at the center of a steroid controversy. And most people familiar with Barry Bonds know that his trainer, Greg Anderson, was convicted of dealing steroids. Mr. Anderson has gone to jail a couple of times for refusing to testify about what he supplied to the slugger. But somehow nobody connected with the Burlingame, California Youth Baseball Association noticed that when he wasn't in prison, Greg Anderson was coaching Burlingame's little leaguers. He'd been doing it for years, and there had never been a complaint. But this year there were some, and Mr. Anderson is no longer in the dugout, to the dismay of several large, moody preteens with deep voices who'd hit nothing but home runs. Nah, I just made that last part up.
I've never had a harder job, more stress and more fatigue than the year I volunteered to coach the Little League.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, Pistol Packing Divas in Pink. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Ooh, danger, Will Robinson.
Danger, absolutely. Lock and load. The Bruins Stanley Cup victory was impressive, but perhaps even more so was Tim Thomas's performance in the net, which some have said was the greatest performance by an NHL goalie in history. Have they got that right?
I think if you take it from the beginning of the playoffs to the very end, there is no question that it is. It certainly was the greatest finals performance by a goalie I've ever seen. I mean, even, you know, one of the ones, memorable ones that comes to mind is Ken Dryden as a young man beating the Bobby Orr Bruins. But even in that series, he had a game where he gave up five goals.
Considerably less impressive was the riot in downtown Vancouver following the Canucks' loss, unless you happen to be impressed by the numbers. 150 people requiring hospital treatment, nearly 100 arrests, damages in the millions of dollars. It goes on and on.
First of all, it's a very impressive riot, as riots go.
Mm-hmm.
In the context of riots, that's a pretty good riot. This is one I do not understand. Are they that disappointed? Why do I get the feeling there were just a whole bunch of people who needed an excuse?
This is our first chance, Charlie, for a tip of the hat to the new NBA champion, Dallas Mavericks. I appreciate the fact that owner Mark Cuban did not stick the city with the costs of the victory parade, but I think I might have paid money to avoid having to listen to this part of the celebration.
We are the champions! We are the champions!
That, of course, is series MVP Dirk Nowitzki, who better stay with his day job, I think.
I was born in Dusseldorf, and that is why they call me Rolf. First of all, the one mitigating factor is it's a really terrible song.
Yes.
So we'll give Dirk a pass on that.
All right, a little post-postseason clarification, please. LeBron James said this week, quote, "I'm not superior or better than anyone else," and certainly that's true regarding various members of the Dallas Mavericks, but that's not exactly what he meant, is it?
Yeah, he had said something in the immediate aftermath of the game, which was undeniably true, if ill-timed, which is basically that a lot of people who vicariously hate him need to get lives and try not to take sports quite so seriously. No athlete, especially losing athletes, is allowed to say that in public anymore, so he has to come back and clarify.
It's LeBron and not Nowitzki who was honored in Peoria, Illinois on Thursday. Charlie, tell our listeners about how the Peoria Chiefs tipped their cap to Mr. James.
They gave away LeBron James championship rings, but the catch was that they don't exist! So essentially, you are handed air.
The world's cheapest promotion.
Exactly.
Thereby making it very attractive to minor league baseball teams. In other basketball news, here's a riddle for you. When are 500 career victories not 500 career victories?
When the NCAA takes them away, which they have done with two of John Calipari's three visits to the Final Four. They vacated the victories he had with UMass and with Memphis in the NCAA tournaments in which they played, which knocks his 500 career wins down a few.
All right, so they already had a celebration of John Calipari's 500 wins, and now we got to subtract the ones that didn't count. Do they do it again when he reaches 500 for real?
They should take it all back, and Kentucky should realize that when you sign this guy, this is the kind of problem you let yourself in for.
Charlie, during this NFL lockout, contact between players and teams has been prohibited, of course, but the Green Bay Packers received permission to hand out the team's Super Bowl rings in a private ceremony on Thursday night. Gee, it was nice of Commissioner Goodell to call a truce for that, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think that, you know, if you want to hand out prizes for the last NFL season we'll ever see in our lifetime, this was probably a good way to do it.
Because the alternative was a guy down the corridor saying, hey,
yeah, kid, come
exactly.
here.
Exactly.
Some guy with a bunch of them
hanging from the inside of his overcoat.
Earlier this week, there were rumors that the NFL and its players were close to an agreement that would have ended the lockout. But, oops, maybe not.
Yeah, the owners are not on the same page. There are at least two owners who are not going to agree to anything except abject surrender. Roger Goodell is going to have to find his way out of this. Good luck, Roger. You embarked on this strategy. Have a nice time with it.
I know Ohio State is all about football, Charlie, but what did you think of President E. Gordon Gee's speech to graduates of the university, some of whom are actually not football players, as I understand it?
Well, he had to say something, and they were graduating inside Ohio Stadium, which meant that, you know, football problems were hanging over everybody, and he pointed out that this, quote, great grand building has been home to disappointment and tumult. That is but a temporary sideshow. And then they all went out and got tattoos.
In other college football scandal news, I suspect that football players at UNC could maybe use remedial tutoring in how to park their cars.
Okay, I know football players running up $13,000 worth of parking tickets is a huge number, and people should be embarrassed. But everybody out there in our listening audience who actually paid the parking tickets you got in college, please stand up. Sit down, you bunch of liars.
I'm standing up.
Sit down, you liar. You did not pay your tickets.
I did.
You did not.
I did.
I want to see records from the New Haven Police Department.
The car was registered in my father's name. He would have killed me.
Sit your butt down, you liar. Liar.
Jamie and Frank McCourt reached a divorce settlement yesterday, Charlie, but we won't know who owns the Dodgers until August. Why not?
Because they have to settle that in a separate hearing, which they're going to have a one-day hearing to determine if the title to the Dodgers. Wouldn't it be great if there was like a pink piece of paper that like you had for your car, which you obviously did not pay your parking tickets on, that said, you know, Los Angeles Dodgers belongs to...
Just
but anyway,
sign it.
They have to decide whether the title is in Frank McCourt's name or whether the team should be community property. Apparently, they can't settle this in the abnormal course of this very abnormal litigation, so they're going to have one-day trial for the Dodgers.
Sounds like a coin flip.
One day,
there's not going to be time for much else.
I think Manny Ramirez owns the Dodgers, if you really want to look at it.
And finally, Charlie, another athlete has gotten himself into trouble via electronic communication. Tell us about the email Brazilian soccer player Marcelo wishes he could call back.
Do not hit reply all. This is a tip from old guys trying to do things on the intertubes. Never hit reply all because it will only get you in trouble. Marcelo sent an email to a friend saying he would be able to play for Real Madrid since he pulled out of a game that Brazil was playing against Scotland, and told his friend that the reason he'd be able to play for Real Madrid was he was faking an injury to get out of the Brazil-Scotland game. This is all well and good, except he also sent the email, reply all, to Brazil manager Mano Menezes, and Mano was not happy.
Charlie Pierce.
I've come to give you a leg injury.
He's the author of Idiot America, as well as several other books. And, of course, he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Liar!
I paid the tickets. Some women play tennis, some women crochet, but the interests of the 15,000 women of the group known as Divas, Women Outdoors Worldwide, run a little more toward the explosive. Only a Game's Karen Given met with the Divas at their international headquarters in Texas, and she has our report.
Ready on the right?
Ready.
Ready on the left?
Ready.
Commence firing.
Every Tuesday night, the Cowtown Divas take over the Shooting Gallery, an indoor firing range in Fort Worth, Texas. For these 2 hours, 30 women will joke with each other, offer fashion tips, and yes, shoot some very loud handguns at hot pink targets printed especially for them. Anjanette Jory has been with the Divas since the group was founded in 1999.
It's a sisterhood. Anybody you meet who has a similar passion, you connect, you automatically have got this thing you can talk about and go do, and you become immediate friends. Same here. People who just like to shoot, or they shoot for the first time a target, and wow, that wasn't as scary as I thought, and they have fun with it. Next thing you know, we're all getting together to go shoot.
The Divas' mission is to bring outdoor sports to women who might not otherwise find them. As many as 75% of Divas had never fired a gun before joining the group, not Anjanette. She says she grew up as a Texas girl who would go to her family's farm on the weekends and shoot for fun. These days, Anjanette is a successful city-dwelling mortgage broker who enjoys surprising people with her not-so-secret passion.
They look at me and they give me a once-over and they go, really? Yes, I shoot. What do you shoot? Pistols, rifles, shotguns. And it's then they just get quiet because they don't really know what to say about that.
Go ahead and bring your targets back in.
The first thing you need to know about the Divas is these women are not tomboys. The Divas like to say that they take shooting sports on their own terms, which not only means that many of them shoot 22s, which have a quieter bang and less kickback than larger calibers, but they also stand on the firing line wearing bedazzled baseball caps and sparkly t-shirts. Anjanette says there's no need to give up fashion in order to shoot a gun.
I love my bling. And my lipstick, and my mascara, and my high heels, and I have been known to shoot in my high heels only when I have to.
We want it to be very functional, but we want it to be stylish, too.
Yeah.
Like we said, our favorite color is leopard.
And bling.
Don't forget
that's
the
a
bling.
Color.
Uh-huh, it is now.
Judy Rhodes is the founder of the Divas. Like Anjanette, she's a former country girl who grew up around firearms and says she couldn't stand to see another generation miss out on her favorite pastime. Beyond that, she wanted to see women participate in outdoor sports in ways they hadn't before.
When I first started, people couldn't even imagine women really shooting in the outdoors, hunting. And when we went to camp, a lot of them just stayed in, you know, back and cooked where the men went out. And I decided that wasn't going to happen anymore. We're going to be out there shooting and hunting and being in our own blind. And now we are.
Judy founded the Divas with 16 of her closest girlfriends. And in the past 12 years, the group has grown to a worldwide membership that spans 19 countries. Judy can't remember all the Divas' first names anymore, but she still treats everyone who shows up like a sister.
Let me walk you through this evening's prizes.
Maggie Aronsi hands out the gifts for tonight's top shooters. There are a couple of cowboy hats, one in zebra print, one in tiger, a cheetah print fragrance warmer, and everyone's favorite, a charming little lion stuffed with a lavender-scented insert that can be heated up in the microwave.
I want him. Aww. Be mine.
Okay, now put it down, and let me show you what you can do when you take your time to get your side picture.
On Thursday nights, the Dallas Divas gather at the Elm Fork Handgun Range. Here, the newest members learn the sport under the watchful eyes of more experienced shooters. The Divas like to say that women are better students of the sport than men. They listen better and follow instructions. They also say that women are best taught to shoot by other women, who might explain things differently than a man would. That's what inspired Carla Smith to purchase her first firearm.
I joined Diva. Wow, a week or so ago, and I mean, lots of emails, lots of fun.
Wait, you joined a week ago,
uh-huh.
And you've already bought a gun,
uh-huh.
And you're already on an email list,
uh-huh.
And you already have a bunch of friends.
Uh-huh. I love this place.
Carla's already planning to go on one of the Divas' camping or hunting adventures. The group also offers clinics on everything from AR-15 semi-automatic rifle shooting to dog training, bird watching, and map orienteering. But for Murrieta Johnson, who's been shooting guns since she was 8, the appeal of the Divas comes not only from what she can learn, but also from what she can teach.
You know, I've been shooting in a man's world for a long time. By myself. And it's nice to have that camaraderie around, having some other women around that, you know, are eager to shoot, that want to learn something. Because when I first started shooting, they're all like, oh, can you coach me? And I'm like, well, I'll tell you what I do, you know. Well,
Judy Rhodes says it's important not to lose another generation of female shooters. Other Divas say it's important for women to know how to protect themselves or to get more quality time with their husbands. But Murrieta says teaching women how to use firearms isn't important at all.
Why is it important for women to play tennis? Why is it important for women to go play golf? To me, it's just another sport. All I'm doing is punching holes in paper, so I can do that all day long. As long as I got ammo, something to shoot with, I'll do that all day.
This is going to put 50 points on your score.
All
right. So you need to do as well as you can. Have a good time, ladies.
After the women get their fill of shooting at the hot pink targets, they're given regular-sized playing cards and asked to shoot out the suit symbols. Tino, the range officer at Elm Fork, doesn't mind seeing his range taken over by such silliness. In fact, he says he prefers it to what sometimes happens on the weekends.
The women are always brought by their dads or their boyfriends or husbands, and they sometimes come like kicking and screaming, you know. So it is pretty cool to see women who actually enjoy it coming here.
I bring my husband on Sundays. He doesn't bring me.
Sally Zimmerman is one of the more experienced Divas. She spends 5 to 6 hours a day shooting, mostly air pistol, in hopes of making the U.S. Olympic team. On league nights, she rushes through her own shots so that she has plenty of time to help the less experienced shooters.
It makes me feel good that I helped somebody improve on something that later on they can enjoy all by themselves without anybody's help. And the fact I could maybe contribute to that enjoyment means a lot to me.
No woman who visits the Divas gets away without a lesson, and that includes me. It's not the first time I've held a gun, but it is the first time I've been taught to hold one by another woman who understands how foreign that cold metal feels in my hands.
Now, until you get ready to shoot,
yeah.
This, your trigger finger should always be right
there.
Oh,
so you don't get to it accidentally.
Exactly.
Right, okay, exactly. Okay.
Sally talks me through every nuance before asking me to pull the trigger. She tells me how to stand, how to breathe, where to look for, what to think about, and what not to think about. Still, I'm not convinced.
I'm not even going to hit a target here.
You're not with that attitude, Missy.
With the divas watching, I let out my breath, check my sight picture, and slowly, very, very slowly, squeeze the trigger.
Not bad.
Where did... Oh!
Ale!
That was pretty good! Oh, very good. You're on the 10 line.
Yay! Very nice.
There you go.
To my amazement, not only did I hit the target, but my first shot is within an inch and a half of the bullseye. I'm happy to quit while I'm ahead, but Sally has more to teach and more bullets loaded in her gun.
Did I even hit that one?
Yes, you did. You know where you hit it?
Where?
Right smack in the middle of the crosshairs.
I did not.
Yeah, you did. You don't even need me anymore. I guess I'm going home.
There's a lot of joking around when you shoot with this group, just like there's a lot of hot pink, leopard print, and bling. But Judy Rhodes says that's all just part of being a diva.
If we're not having fun, you know how women are, we don't do it. And with our organization, we might be just a little bit louder or a little bit blingier and things like that, but I always say moths come to the flame.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Gibbon.
They call me Annie Oakley, Annie, Annie Oakley, queen of the golden west. With a hey, giddy up, and a bang, 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 my riding and my shooting are the best.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Gibbon and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Kurt Nickisch. Our intern is Allison Gluck, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view pictures of Karen on the shooting range or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Divas founder Judy Rhodes.
And one thing that's really surprised me about women is they really enjoy the smell of gunpowder. Chanel, yes, but gunpowder, that was never on my list.
Yeah, me neither. Grapefruit's good, though, and vanilla, stuff like that. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
They call me Annie Oakley, Annie, Annie Oakley, queen of the golden west.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR.